Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home. They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
Well, you can laugh. I'm the Walcott.
I'm a little bit of an idealist. But having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'm going to need it there.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
I'm down Swampfield, and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawny man?
Is there a more overused sentence formulation in football punditry and indeed management speak currently than, if you'd offered me situation X at time Y, I'd have snapped your bloody hand off? This has in the past couple of years become almost ubiquitous, particularly it seems in relation to the Ireland men's national team, who kept falling backwards into major tournament playoff games no matter how many games we lost there. That went on for a couple of years at least. Well, last Friday I predicted a convincing 5-0 win for Manchester City in Saturday's FA Cup final, and after 13 seconds of the game in Wembley, if you'd offered me a 2-1 loss for Man United, well, I'd have snapped your bloody hand off. Hello and welcome to today's second bank holiday football show. Hello there, Ken.
Hello, Kieran. How are you doing?
Was that overly pessimistic? Because I thought my original prediction was actually going to be pretty much on the money.
Yeah, well, after, I thought it was only 12 seconds, but maybe it was 13.
I allowed myself a second to digest there then, if we were going to disagree on the exact goal time of Ilkay Gundogan's first goal.
What did you think? I mean, what was your reaction? Obviously, it would be better if we had live recordings of this, but I mean, you can perhaps... What was the circumstance? I mean, you were there, you'd probably psyched yourself up, you were thinking, you were probably rubbed your hands together a couple of times.
Yeah.
Get into these lads.
Into these early lads. Early, you know, an early game reducer, perhaps. You know, that sort of thing seems to really work against this Man City team. But, no, I'll tell you what happened, Ken.
Yeah.
I had an appointment with the dog groomer at 3 p.m.
Oh, for fuck's
sake. You're kidding me here. But as it turned out, listen, I took a risk. I landed up at the dog groomers 10 to 3.
Mm.
And who do I see walking out? Only the previous customer.
Oh.
Looking great, by the way, as well. Looking absolutely brilliant.
That's good.
So I was like, have I come a little early? Maybe this is the perfect time. And the dog groomer in question said, you're absolutely spot on. Hand her over to me there and you can be on your way. And I made it back to the couch with about maybe 30 seconds to spare before the game actually kicked off.
You did see it.
So I gave it the full FA Cup final build-up. I know I was talking on Friday about, you know, it's a proper FA Cup final. I obviously had completely forgotten about this dog grooming appointment.
Mm.
But, so I saw none of the build-up. None of Abide with Me. None of, I'm sure they met some dignitaries of some sort on the pitch or whatever. I saw none of that. All I saw was basically the teams breaking up from their pre-match huddle and Ilkay Gundogan taking
the ball,
the kickoff.
Yeah.
And that's basically all it was. So it wasn't like I'd spent, you know, sort of the previous hour and a half, you know, psyching myself up, building myself up mentally, spiritually, emotionally for a Manchester United, for a bravura Manchester United performance.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, at the exact moment that the goal went in, Ken,
yeah,
I did think, this could be a long old day.
It was the goal. It was the moment in a cup final of any kind that was definitely most like a joke. I think you had to actually have absorbed some of the build up to really you know, the way that you saw it, it was just a punchline, you know?
Yeah. Whereas I didn't get the lengthy setup.
With the build up and all of the stuff and all, you know, the people marching around and the songs and, you know, Fergie.
Yeah.
Fergie there. Booed, I believe, by the Man City fans. I don't know if they cheered Summerbeat. There was videos also showing the Man City players walking out, apparently. All of the Man United players were obviously greeting Alex Ferguson, who remains the main man. But on the other side, the City players, if they knew who Mike Summerbee was, didn't seem to be. They had the game face on. It was no time for chit chat with Mike Summerbee.
Is that John Stones' outlaw? What's he doing out here?
And you know,
basically asking each other
all this, the anthems, Prince William, you know, all of this stuff. And then it kicks off and bang, it's 1-0. It was absolutely incredible. I mean, what a goal as well. What a goal by Gundogan. What an impact he's been having over the last, I think it's 5 goals in his last 6 games and 5 in the previous 44. He scored as many goals basically in the last few weeks as he had in the all rest of the season, which has just brought him up to his season average. He usually scores about this many goals. It's not as though he's completely hit a new level this season goals wise. It's just that they've all come at the best time, really. I mean, he has a habit of this. He did it last season on the last day as well. And what a goal! And you know, and part of the build up to the game as well. You know, John McKenzie, who we spoke to on the podcast about Leeds a couple of weeks back. I had watched his. One of his TIFO videos, sort of a tactical video, you know, which had the title along the lines of, you know, how Erik ten Hag can stop Manchester City, you know? And so it was kind of trying to think about the problem, you know, if you have to manage Manchester United in this game, what do you do against this team that is dominating everybody? Obviously, they had beaten them back in January, I guess. I can't remember if it was January, but they beat them at Old Trafford in the, you know, having lost heavily in the first league match. But since then, John McKenzie makes the point that City have changed their system completely. You know, so in that first game, they had a back four. You know, they had Foden and Mahrez on the wings. Since then, pretty much from that point, they've changed the basic structure. You know, it's a back three, Stones in midfield, Grealish and Silva on the wings, and a different style and a different problem to solve. And so the video, I don't know, went on for 16 or 17 minutes talking about the various problems presented by, you know, Man City's build-up structure. You know, the how do you press? Where do you press? If you press high, what happens in behind? You know, City obviously doing all these little Roberto De Zerbi three-man moves. You know, get into the, you know, it's all about like getting a man into the area that a guy who is pressing has just run out of in order to press. So if he's pressing in one direction, then that means there's space where? Behind him. So that's where we turn up, and that's where we're thinking about getting the ball to. You know, all these types of things, and how you can sort of what players you should pick, what sort of formations you should make. You know, he came to the conclusion, I think, that it's kind of a 4-2-2-2 United should be going with. You know, take Eriksen out of there, I remember, was one of the recommendations. You know, basically accept that you're not going to be able to stop them building up, try and press them more aggressively in the middle third, you know, and then hope to get Rashford away, you know, and so on and so forth. And you're just thinking about all this, thinking about them spending all week, you know, looking at this problem.
I mean, forget about 16 or 17 minutes. I mean, this has probably been like a month's work. How can we keep a clean sheet against these?
And then just
this mob?
And almost a contemptuous, like a route one.
Get it launched to the big man.
Get it launched. You know, you got Big Erling.
Win the second ball.
Big Erling, who's expecting it all the way? Because if you look at what happens, Ortega, I mean, the ball goes, Gundogan goes straight back to Ortega, and then Ortega's there. And, you know, it's not as though people run up and try and put him under immediate pressure. You know, United are thinking, no, we're too clever for that. We're not going to play it the way you want. And then he launches it, and you see that Haaland, and he launches it quite accurately to an area where Haaland, who has backed away to the right wing, can get a good running jump at this, you know, running towards the ball as though he was a defender, to run at a ball that's coming towards him and get there ahead of Casemiro, who's kind of backpedaling a little bit, and beats him easily in the air. Then it goes through, and it was Lindelof then who's got an awkward ball to deal with, heads it into De Bruyne, bounces, it just loops rather. I don't think it actually bounced before Gundogan running onto it, just lashed it in, and it was just you just have to say, well, that was an amazing goal, and all of these, all the plans, everything is
forget
just,
about it. Yeah.
You know, this is the way.
It's unbelievable.
It's going to be this kind of a day, and of course, it ended up, as you said, Smurf, being closer than maybe people were expecting after 13 seconds that it was going to be. For which I think it would be churlish not to look to the people who made that possible, who were the referee Paul Tierney and the VAR official David Coote. I mean, they then proceeded to show that Man City, you know, I mean, it was amazing. There was three huge decisions that they gave Manchester United's way in the first half, which all of which sort of kept the game on life support from United's point of view, you know, kept them alive. Obviously, there was the penalty that they awarded for this handball by Jack Grealish. A technically correct decision, I think. You know, Grealish is jumping. I mean, the rule, we saw, for instance, in the Europa League final, a really obvious handball committed by the Sevilla midfielder Fernando, who I think it was Matic, crosses it in for Roma, and it's a really obvious handball. The hand actually moves slightly out as well from the body, stops the ball. Everyone in the stadium sees it. You know, the Roma bench are all jumping up, led obviously by Jose. Everyone's seen the handball, but they decided, nah, that's not a handball, because his hand is basically down. Hand points down. Not handball. This is where we've got to now. It's a handball. It's a blocked cross. If you're going to give a penalty for handling balls that are otherwise going into a danger area, this is a penalty. But no, because the arm is in a natural position, which is this ridiculous, a meaningless phrase, which you can apply really to any arm that hasn't been, you know, wrenched out.
As Gary Lineker said, as long as it's attached to the body, you'd have to say that's a natural position for an arm, as he said at halftime.
Utter nonsense. Okay, so, but they decide, no, it's natural position. We're not going to give that. Even though the ball has actually traversed a far greater distance from Matic's foot to Fernando's hand than the ball did off Wan-Bissaka's head to Grealish's hand, which, I mean, Grealish is jumping basically to contest an aerial ball. The ball is headed into his hand, which is behind him, in the direction that he's not looking, from like a yard away. And this is a penalty. Why? Because if hand down isn't penalty, then what's hands up?
Penalty all the way.
Hand up is penalty. Penalty. So these are the rules that we have. These are the great set of rules. The current rules, because they'll be changing them. They've changed the handball rules so many times since VAR came in and complicated the whole situation, overcomplicated it so much. So that was a decision that they gave. I think technically a correct decision.
The other two, I should mention, we have Mark Critchley and John Bruin coming up in a few minutes for their FA Cup final thoughts.
Well, to be honest, they're more Manchester United post-mortem thoughts because and I know people, well, whoa, this is unbelievable, what are you talking about? No, Manchester City have a big week this week. We're gonna get the opportunity to talk about Man City. I'm going to be going to see them play in the Champions League final on Saturday. There's going to be no shortage.
Reporting live from the banks of the Bosphorus with your customary elan this week. I'm looking forward to it immensely.
There's no shortage of opportunities to talk about that, and we will. But for today, we're going to focus more on the side whose season is finished.
Okay, so the two other decisions, Casemiro, possible red card, which was adjudged to be a Manchester United free. What was the third decision?
Hang on, did they give a free kick to United for that?
Yeah, they did, yeah.
I missed that detail. I mean, okay, so that's what that is a clear case where you can send the player off here. You know, you've got a guy who's gone over the ball, studs up into the shin in a dangerous way. I've seen red cards given this season. I've seen Casemiro sent off this season. Actually, both of the red cards that he had were not as bad as that fell. right? I mean, one of them was like a ridiculous, like, non-push, you know, or he's supposedly choking somebody. And, okay, but they didn't give that. Again, it's a huge decision in Manchester United's favour. That was before the penalty, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
It was before the penalty. So that was a big decision. It was almost as though they were like, well, you know, I mean, do we really want to do this? I don't think many people watching the game, apart from all the Man City fans, wanted necessarily to see a Man United player get sent off. Just from the point of view of having a game, it might be good for the team that's already manifestly superior and leading 1-0 to have an extra man as well. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That shouldn't be in the referee's thinking, though. The point is, okay, they gave the decision to Manchester United. That's nice. Then this decision on the 40 minutes. This was when it was 1-1. United were back in the game, at least on the scoreboard. Is it Bernardo Silva gets away down the left, cuts the ball back. De Bruyne is coming in from the edge of the box. He's going to have a clear shot at this. This is going to be a goal. Fred just trips him up. And, okay, it's obviously it's a penalty. On the first instance, I'm like, that looks to me like a penalty. Let's see what happened there. Because this is what you can do when you're, you know, you've got VAR. It's like, well, if it is a penalty, we'll surely see that. All you hear then is, check complete. Okay, then they show the replay, which is the clearest trip that you can imagine. You know, Fred, he knows De Bruyne is coming. De Bruyne has got a little bit of a start on him. He knows he's not going to be able to stop him getting there first. So all that's left is to stop him getting there. And he tries to come across to sort of block him, but he doesn't get across with his hip or with his shoulder or with any other part of his body that he might plausibly claim, look, we were going for a ball. I'm shielding that ball that's 5 yards away. I'm shielding the ball. You know, he just trips him. It's foot to, you know, leg just below knee, trips him up, blatant penalty. Not given.
Listen, they're in the entertainment business, Ken. You know what I mean? No one wants to see that on FA Cup Finals.
But how can we have this nonsense? Now, I know that you're like, I can't believe you're talking about the referee. I have to say, right, the game itself wasn't a great game. It was one of those, I thought City were kind of quite comfortable for most of it. Obviously, the timing of the second goal for City kind of killed off the second half a little bit. You know, they scored very quickly in the second half. And from that point on, they were back to where they were at 1-0, which is, okay, all we need to do is just get through this without making a mistake. You know, and I felt that was their main thing. Okay, let's just keep the ball away from these guys. Let's not get ourselves into any situation where they can get their guys running through into space. That's the thing that Guardiola is always obsessed about with teams. Like, you know, he talks about it with United a lot. He talks about it with Real Madrid. These, you know, great historic clubs, Guardiola's, you know, who he doesn't think play that good football. He's just like, they're very good in the counterattack. When they have space, they will kill you. They will kill you. So it's all about denying them that. And City basically did effectively do that. Eventually, Garnacho came on and looked like maybe he could spark something. And then there was the kind of late, you know, a couple of efforts, the McTominay jumping around, Varane hitting the bar and all that.
Death or glory type efforts.
But it wasn't really, minutes. Yeah, and they'd made sort of very attacking substitutions and Varane had moved up front, I think. And it was high risk, but it wasn't really dangerous. I mean, there was some worrying aspects of it, I thought, from, you know, like the way that Eriksen made no impact. I mean, there was a moment in the first half when Eriksen was beaten by Kevin De Bruyne and then tried to foul him twice and couldn't get to him, just couldn't get close enough to foul the guy to bring him down from behind, which was obviously not great. He was off the pace all day. He was substituted. late on, there was a situation with Grealish and Gundogan. Gundogan gave the ball to Grealish. And then Casemiro was sort of marking Gundogan. Gundogan decides, I'm going to run to the byline here. And Grealish finds him with a beautifully weighted sort of outside of the foot pass, plays it sort of into space for Gundogan to chase. Casemiro's nowhere. And you think, okay, Gundogan has spun away from Casemiro in such a way that Casemiro momentarily lost where he was, and then suddenly he was gone. That's not what happened, though. What happened was Casemiro saw exactly what Gundogan was going to do and just couldn't chase him. He couldn't follow him. You know, what I'm saying is, if this match had gone to extra time, like it's hard to imagine Casemiro would have still been there 120 minutes. You know, like these were sort of not good things to see for Manchester United. And obviously then there was the goalkeeping mistake by De Gea. I mean, at first I was thinking, is it really his fault? It's come through a few players. It's a bit of an awkward one. It was Peter Schmeichel who convinced me that, yeah, no, this is his fault.
No, I have to say, I turned over, like, at the moment of the final whistle, there was some GA action. I was anxious to to turn my attention to. So I didn't see any of the post-match stuff, but yeah. I will say that I wasn't waiting around for Peter Schmeichel to tell me that was a goalkeeping error.
Yeah.
All I had to see was replays of the second bounce that the shot
took. Two bounces
took.
Is never good.
Two bounces, but the second bounce was so high, it was so high off the ground that it told me that this was not a shot that was
moving,
you know,
very
kissing
fast.
The kissing
skidding
the ground,
along
you
the
know,
ground.
Yes, yeah, like it was literally a bobble. It just like it bobbled up in the air, and De Gea was still incapable of getting across his goal line in time to save it. It is just, it's just really bad goalkeeping. It's just a really, it's just a really weak shot to be beaten by.
Yeah, I in the fullness of time, having looked at it, I do agree. And I mean, he's had a comical season in some ways. The story of his season really has just highlighted the whole dilemma of De Gea. He is the golden glove. You know, he has more clean sheets than any other goalkeeper.
When he's good, he's very, very good.
He has to share the credit for that, I suppose, with his
defenders.
Defenders, yeah. Of course. But at key moments, he's made terrible mistakes. The one against West Ham really stands out. You know, that ridiculous goal that West Ham scored where he, you know, how can you let that in? But maybe the most consequential one was against Sevilla, you know? His awful performance against Sevilla, especially in the away leg. I mean, there was a ridiculous goal that he conceded after coming out of his box and then, you know, not controlling a ball. But then there was the at 2-2 right at the beginning of the second leg, his terrible efforts to play out from the back, sort of leading United straight into trouble, from which they conceded a goal, and you know that cost them that. I mean, Sevilla obviously have gone on to win that competition. If United had come through that, well, ultimately I guess it would have been...
Let's not make any hasty conclusions as to what Man United may or may not have done winning that tie and potentially winning a final. But certainly, Sevilla, they were proven to have been the best team left in it. So,
yeah. His bad football, like, you know, his bad sort of footballing abilities have been a kind of an issue for some time. And, you know, at the start of the season, we were talking about how that might be a problem for United. But you could always sort of at least depend on this, like, good goalkeeping qualities, you know, traditional goalkeeping qualities. And then, you know, you get episodes like Sevilla and this, and you're just like, well, I mean, what exactly are we talking about here? There's no reason for this guy to be one of the highest paid goalkeepers in the world. And really, it's time. Anyway, we'll talk with Mark and John maybe a bit more about that among some other things. But on the subject of why I was talking about the refereeing, I think it's... I mean, since we last spoke, there was these videos of the referee Anthony Taylor being abused in the airport as he... Mm-hmm. in Budapest. He obviously was the referee who at the Europa League final. There was a couple of mistakes or a couple of controversial calls, let's say. He gave a penalty by mistake to Sevilla, which was rescinded on VAR. Mourinho still seemed to be blaming him for that after the game. Mourinho obviously had this ridiculous waiting in the car park to abuse him. Like a pathetic sight, has been charged by UEFA, should be punished to the maximum possible extent that they can punish him, because he's been doing this for his whole life. He hasn't stopped. He's a repeat offender. And so they should punish him, because he's disgusting and he's a disgrace. He was annoyed about a couple of things, though, and I can kind of see why. there's elements of his frustration. We've already talked about that Fernando penalty. That would have been a penalty to Roma.
Yeah.
Randomly, they didn't give that. And then there was a moment in the shootout when they intervened to say, actually, Rui Patricio, you've stepped off your line there. So we'll have to retake that penalty, which you just thought you'd saved to give your team a lifeline. We're going to retake it just so that Gonzalo Montiel's got a second chance to drive this stake through your heart, which he duly did. Now, again, that's a technically correct decision, but it's a VAR decision. It's been the law that you can't come off your line at a penalty kick. I don't know why the law says this, but that's been the law since 1905, I think. Certainly more than 100 years, right? When did you ever see it punished, right? It was because it was so difficult to really tell. Did he move a little bit off his line?
Well, I mean, you've got to, there used to be two linesmen, now there are two assistant referees who, let's face it, don't have a whole pile to be doing during a penalty shootout. They probably could step up and actually call this.
Yeah, but, you know, at the same time, you can be sure with VAR. So looking at it, he doesn't even really step so much as sort of almost hop off. You know, he's kind of hopping on the balls of his feet, Rui Patricio this is. And then the last little hop is like a step forward. He doesn't, to me, seem to get any real advantage out of it. But he does do it, and he is off his line at the moment the ball is struck. Therefore, retake. Now, the problem there, I think, is that this rule shouldn't be. I mean, I don't understand the laws of the game as they apply to goalkeepers in penalty situations. I think they should be allowed to run out of their goal. Like, you know, if they should be allowed to be anywhere in the six-yard box. Like, as long as they're not outside the six-yard box, I think that would be a fairer rule. Instead, what we actually have is a situation where they're making it more restrictive. You know, they announced a couple of months ago that clarification, this is IFAB, so the law changes for next season, clarification that the goalkeeper must not behave in a manner that fails to show respect for the game and the opponent, i.e. by unfairly distracting the kicker. In other words, the Emilio Martinez
rule. Yeah,
that's what we have here. The defending goalkeeper must remain on the goal line facing the kicker between the goalposts without touching the goalpost, crossbar or goal net until the ball is kicked. The goalkeeper must not behave in a way that unfairly distracts the kicker, e.g. delay the taking of the kick or touch the goalpost, crossbar or goal net. Kind of like, why though? why not let the goal
absurd rule
be, just, at least give them a sporting chance. If we're going to give penalties for ridiculous non-offenses like the Grealish handball, you know, because again, this is a VAR thing. Again, it's like, oh, there's been a fractional, the ball has brushed the player's fingertips, we must, you know, get together and award a penalty, you know, for this like unthreatening situation. We're going to magic a penalty out of it, and then we're also going to insist that the goalkeeper basically has to we're going to make it more difficult for the goalkeeper to save it. I think allow the goalkeeper to do whatever. I mean, you know, it would become a skill.
I don't think advancing down the pitch, as they would say in cricket, is necessarily fair. I mean, if the kick is from 11 yards, it should be from 11 yards. You know what I mean?
The kick's from 11 yards. The goal's not going to move. I mean, it's 12 yards. It's 11 meters, half meter. Yeah.
Sorry. but I mean, I do think that, like, I was going to start saying the rule should stay the rule just because the rule has always been there. I don't know. It's not something I've thought about.
You know,
if the rule is in place, then it should be enforced.
I mean,
because, you know, there are, like, Stephen Cluxton, I'm sorry to again bring Jay into this, but I mean, Stephen Cluxton, like, charges down the pitch and has saved numerous penalties in Ireland finals because he's, like, way off his line. I mean, if it's not police, then why wouldn't you do it?
And I don't see the problem with that. I think it would be good to make it more difficult to score penalties, especially if penalties are being awarded for silly, you know, things like this, this Grealish handball or whatever.
So when I start my run up, you're allowed to start advancing towards me.
Yeah. Say you can't come out of the 6 yard box. You know, I mean, I don't know what a goalkeeper, different goalkeepers would come up with different solutions. I mean, it would make it a bit more individual. You know, the one video that was doing the rounds after this Sevilla thing was Dudek in the Champions League final, where he literally is almost, he's kind of zigzagging out of his goal towards the Milan. You know, I mean, this was illegal at the time, but in reality, these rules were not really enforced. VAR has changed that. So you got this moment when the referees intervene at, like, the basically to kill Roma. They're practically dead anyway. They're almost without hope, but just to extinguish their last hope with just we have to enforce a really, really pedantic rule here. it's kind of maddening. But then you get this situation where this referee is being abused, and obviously Jose Mourinho has a lot of responsibility for that. But I feel as though these types of decisions, these types of VAR, the way that VAR has changed the perception of what referees doing is equally as destructive a force in terms of people's attitude towards referees, the suspicion of corruption and conspiracy that increasingly is like the normal way to react to a decision that goes against your team. You know, this has happened quite quickly. This actually used not be the way. You know, a relatively short time ago. And now it's like, it's everywhere. You know, it's like, the problem, you know, you got a problem. So, on the one hand, I'm not saying that Mourinho shouldn't be punished or, like, lay off Jose. Like, Mourinho is a disgrace, and he's terrible, and there are always going to be people like that who are going to do this. Like, he's been persecuting referees and blaming his failures on them forever, like, for his whole career, and he's not the only one, and that's bad. But what you have now is a situation where referees are forced into intervening in micro situations, but also reviewing evidence, reviewing video evidence, and making wrong decisions. Like that De Bruyne Fred decision is one of the worst. I can't, like, it's just such a clear penalty. It's a trip. It's deliberate. It's trying to prevent a goal. I cannot understand how they don't give that, but they don't. And so then you're left to wonder why. And the reason is, in my opinion, the reason is, the guy's incompetent. Like, he doesn't know what he's doing. He's made a mistake. This is another mistake. You can make mistakes looking at video several times, just the same way as you can make mistakes refereeing a match in the old fashioned way, or the non-top level way that still exists, you know, in real time. But it's just harder for people to understand how you can make the mistake when you view the evidence. You know what I mean? So I think that is why, I mean, I think it is something that has to be considered when you look at a disgraceful scene like what was happening to Anthony Taylor. And I kind of feel as though this is becoming more sort of common. I mean, there've been a lot of these kind of disorderly scenes in general, but in terms of the kind of invective that's directed at referees, this innovation, which was meant to make their position easier and take pressure off them, has in effect made it much more difficult. It's made them much more central. It's had them making big decisions on all kinds of ridiculous minor things that they actually wouldn't have needed to get involved in before. And then when they do make a mistake, everybody's screaming, well, this is obviously corrupt, because how can he not give a penalty there? I mean, how many times does he need to see this before he knows that Fred has tripped De Bruyne? And, you know, luckily for them, City won the game. Imagine City hadn't won that game and that decision. After the last time Man United beat City in the decision in that game, can you imagine what would have happened? I think certainly the Jose in the car park thing would have been the second most viewed manager video of the week.
So, for you to ask that question, pretty strange. Yeah, very disappointed, yeah, but there you go.
What have I become? My sweetest friend.
I mean, at the time I thought that you were completely in the right.
Everyone I know.
But now I think
goes away.
Should have just played in,
I'm surprised you're really asking that question.
And you could have it all.
No, well, it doesn't matter really what you think.
My empire of dirt.
Yeah, you weren't there at the time.
I will let you down.
You weren't an international player.
I will make you hurt.
And you hadn't had the frustrations I had.
If I could start again.
You've not played at the international level.
A million miles away.
And you hadn't been accused of taking an injury, so
I would keep myself.
What you think doesn't really matter.
I would find a way.
Well, to talk about the game on Saturday and the outlook for Manchester United in a bit more detail, we're joined now by John Bruman. How are you doing, John?
I'm okay, Ken. Thanks for having me.
And also by Mark Critchley. How are you, Mark?
I'm good, thanks, Ken. All good.
That's great. You know, Mark, recently I was reading, obviously, the sad death occurred of the legendary novelist Martin Amis. And in the course of the tributes that were being paid to him, I saw a piece that I missed at the time, but it was Martin Amis's report of traveling as a fan. I guess he was a Man United fan, to the 1999 Champions League final on the occasion of the previous as yet still only English treble. And he wrote this piece about, you know, getting up very early and going to the airport and traveling there with United fans and coming straight back after. And it was, I mean, you know, it, I guess 90% of it was about logistical arrangements. 10%, if that, was about the match, one of the most legendary in Champions League, in European Cup history, I suppose. But really, it was the logistics that that captured his attention. And I understand, Mark, that your own appreciation of Saturday's FA Cup final may have been similarly tinged by the effort that the Athletic forced you to go through to get there.
Yeah, I didn't realise I was going up against Martin Amis. I certainly feel even worse about this.
You're the Martin Amis de nos jours.
Well, yeah, we'll see about that. That's not entirely a good thing from my understanding of Martin Amis's back catalogue anyway. But so the job that I was given was to experience the fan experience on a weekend when obviously the country wasn't working and the train strikes meant that no trains were running out of Manchester. So yeah, that was my FA Cup final, was involved going back to Chorley, where I'm from, on Friday night with a mate of mine from school who's United home and away, etc., and getting up at 4:30 in the morning, getting a coach from Leyland, which is in Lancashire, for people that don't, Leyland buses, is that a thing that people might be familiar with?
They're world famous. Everybody knows Leyland.
Yes, Leyland, of course. Phil Jones's hometown, and actually the coach is organised by a few of Phil Jones's mates, and he travels on it sometimes as well. So there was that nice little bit of colour, and yeah, it was eventful, very all very welcoming. I hit the wall at about 10 a.m., I would say. And it's a wall that I'm still kind of peeling myself off now as we speak, 36 hours later. But, enjoyable. And, yeah, I would say that my piece actually has even less of a historic football match in it than Martin Amis's does. It must comprise about 2% of it, because there's a line in there about Ilkay Gundogan's goal and the fact that in the end everybody was in the ground in time to witness it, even if it only was after 12 seconds. But mostly just focused on what a shit country England is to try and get around these days.
Yeah, John, what was your impression of the match itself? I mean, City, did they ease to victory? I think they might have eased to victory.
Yeah, it was one of those wins where a team is going for, say, a title or edging through a cup tie, and they do just enough to hold off the other opposition. But they also give the opposition the idea that they've made a competition of it. Speaking from a Manchester United side of it, you could say that what positive can Manchester United take out of it? Well, they didn't get gubbed. That's the thing. The humiliation of another 6-3 or something like that didn't happen. And there were occasional flickers that Manchester City looked troubled. I think particularly in the performance of Garnacho when he came on. I thought it was excellent. But I suppose if you're talking of Manchester United in the round, when you talk about a performance of someone like Garnacho, then you have to compare it to the impact of players like Jadon Sancho, oh dear, about Weghorst. Well, I think we're sort of beyond discussing what Weghorst does, because we know that it's nothing. And the thing is, talking about going uphill and down Dale to go to these finals. Well, I was one of those fans in 1999. I went to Barcelona, woke up in a resort, stayed in a resort in Spain, to which whose name I have no recollection. Woke up on a train heading for Valencia with someone waking me up, because otherwise I would have ended up in Valencia alone. You know, that's everything. I've been through that. But, years on, when you think of it, and you think of at the point that Manchester United were there, the crest of Manchester United, supporting Manchester United, you realise actually how difficult it was to get to that point, and actually how much more difficult it will be for Manchester United to get to that point now. When you look at the standards set by Manchester City with this best-in-class academy of football that Pep Guardiola has grown through means that many people don't agree with, and this, you know, this how good Manchester City are. Because, listen, last time I was with you two, we debated 99 versus the present day. It's a different game. We accept that. But I think the parameters and the conditions are so much harder now. And if Manchester United wants to get back to that stage, the thing that I came away thinking was it's a long, 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 long road back.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going to be able to talk about Man City a lot over the next few days, because obviously they're approaching the summit. It's, you know, a big match in Istanbul next week. So there's going to be plenty of City talk, which is why I want to talk mainly here about Manchester United, whose season is now over. And I wonder, Mark, if I can ask you crudely to give a mark out of 10 to Erik ten Hag's performance in his first season as United manager.
Specifically Erik ten Hag's performance.
Erik ten Hag is the new guy. He's the captain of the ship now. What do you give him out of 10 based on his first season?
I'd give him an 8, to be honest. An 8. I think, look, if you were here last summer, who seriously even thought they would get top 4? I think that has
not
to
me.
Be. Not me neither. Did you even think they'd finish above 6th, really?
I thought that they would finish somewhere between 5th and 8th, but they have exceeded that expectation.
It's still quite a range of positions there that you've put.
I didn't want to tie myself down, but I did state definitively that no, the top 4 was unlikely, so they did. What about you, John? Would you go as high as 8?
7.5, 7. I think one of the things about Ten Hag is that, okay, if you look at it from a point of view, achieving objectives, they won a trophy, right, fine. They got top 4, okay, that's maybe above expectations. They got to a final, another final, and they didn't get cubbed. You know, that again is almost an objective achieved. One of the problems is, though, that I'm not entirely convinced that having achieved that in one season, that the progress that follows is guaranteed. That's one of the issues that I've got, because I was at Brentford, you know, this darkest day, darkest hour before the dawn. And the thing is,
this is the second game of the season.
In baking heat. Yeah. And you just thought, there's no way almost that United can come back from that. And they did. And there was a power of recovery. But the thing is that I've never quite removed that ability to think that this could fall apart at any minute, because it's built on such shallow foundations. Obviously, the Liverpool game, the Newcastle performance, the Sevilla performance. There's so many where you think this is on very shaky foundations. And the other thing with Ten Hag is, does the football fit into what Manchester United fans want as a template of great football? It's still quite negative, I'd say. There's a lot of hanging on for dear life, hitting you forwards, hoping Marcus Rashford, Garnacho, whoever does it for you. Is it better than Oli Ball? Yes, but not by much. Do I expect there to be better progress than that? Yes, I do. But I think, again, as I said, the standards from one club in particular, and maybe from another in Newcastle, we'll have to see how they go, and we'll see how Arsenal go. But, you know, we're back actually to this discussion that I probably had with you and Mark and Owen and Miguel and all the rest of it. This idea of, like, a transfer window has got to turn over the club. It's got to transform the club, rather than you thinking this is a really strong team and, you know, just a couple of more changes and they can do it in the style that we've seen with Manchester City, we've seen with Liverpool, where only minor alterations are needed to keep that team competing. United is still miles behind where they want to be.
Yeah, I think this is one thing I was thinking about last night. They end the season in a weird position. It's a strange position. It's everything that John just said there, is that it's a good season and there's been progress. And you're left thinking, what, there's still so much work that needs to be done. And it's quite rare for a team to... And I've just argued, really, that Ten Hag's overachieved on expectations beyond what a lot of people thought was possible. But to still arrive at that point at the end of it and think, well, this lot needs to go, this lot needs to come in, this position needs sorting, this position needs sorting, is something that is pretty rare for clubs. So I think it's ultimately, it's a continuation of the issues that were in place at the end of last season. I mean, they spent upwards of $200 million in the market last summer, but that couldn't really mask the scale of the rebuild. And it's about how you rebuild as well. And like, you know, I think you'd look at the players that came in last summer and you wouldn't really criticise any of them for the seasons that they've had, particularly those that have certainly played a big part in what's in the progress that's been made. But I don't know, like, Casemiro's as old as Casemiro is right now and isn't going to last forever. Christian Eriksen yesterday, I think, and over the last few months, really, I think the limitations of his position in this team and what he can do and the fact that he has to come off after about an hour every single game, that's been a glaring aspect of what's of the last few months and the sticky form that there's been over the last few months. How you start to, you know, we'll probably go into bigger discussions about strikers and De Gea and the goalkeeping situation, etc. But how you begin to make the improvements that need to be made within FFP, while and the understanding that a lot of the things that we're hearing at the moment is that they essentially need to sell players in order to be able to buy significantly and do the work that needs to be done. There'll be some business before that, but they need to sell. It's something that they've never been very good at. So there's just so much work that needs to be done. It's work that's really was still needed to be done last summer as well, and it's work that may need to be done the summer 2024. That's just the position that United were in at the end of last season, and it was never going to be fixed in one season's time.
Okay, well, I mean, the idea that they need to sell is interesting. Who do you think? I mean, because obviously there's always speculation about players Manchester United are going to bring in, and not so much maybe about who they're going to have to get rid of in order to make that possible. Who do you think is on the way out now? I mean, Maguire is someone I've been mentioned, but you know that doesn't sound like that lucrative a deal when the Daily Mail report that Manchester United will be paying him £10 million to leave the club. You know what I mean? It doesn't seem as though it's undercutting the profitability somewhat. I mean, are there any other players... not necessarily who they have to pay to leave, but who they might be looking at as potentially players they don't need that they could get some money for.
I think the squad is as big and as bloated really as it's ever been. It's not felt like that at times when there's been particular injury problems or you're looking for somebody to come in to be able to do a job and not there's been nobody there. But it is still quite large. And look, I'm thinking off the top of my head, the list of names, you've obviously mentioned Maguire. I think his position is becoming pretty untenable and has been for a while. And he will probably think so himself and think that if he wants to be a player of the status that he had a couple of years ago, he needs to play football regularly. That's natural. Other players you'd think, I don't know, somebody like Scott McTominay perhaps hasn't been playing as much as he was a couple of seasons ago. I think with him, there's a case that actually getting him off the books would help with these new FFP sustainability regulations that are coming in because this whole amortization thing, he's obviously an academy player. So
it's just mad how this system just makes it profitable to get rid of, like, your, you know,
young the players, heart and soul. Yeah.
It's just absolutely,
it's absolutely
crazy.
Outrageous, isn't it? It really is. I mean, I don't know if you chaps saw an interview with David Beckham after the final.
I didn't say it. I saw Bex certainly hanging out at the final. He's fairly visible. Yeah, I didn't see his interview.
Well, David did a bit of a mix zone turn, which, you know, ever the pro.
Yeah.
And he talked about, he was asked actually the difference between the Manchester City potential treble team and obviously the one that did it. And he talked about how Manchester United was made up of homegrown players and this obviously annoyed the Manchester City fans because they're just like, well, you're not homegrown anyway. You're from, you know, you're from Leytonstone. And actually they had the... And then, of course, we moved into the debate of what was Manchester United's transfer bill of that time. You know, they were the biggest spenders in English football and all this type of thing. Mm. But actually the interesting point is that you make is that for Manchester United, if that had been in an FFP era, they might have had to sell Beckham, Giggs, you know, the Neville.
Well, they definitely would have been incentivized to sell them.
It's, exactly, yeah, yeah. So, and it does seem to be the wrong way around, doesn't it? That like, I've often thought, you know, the best teams in world football history are like a, you know, a Barcelona that is built from La Masia Academy. Maybe that team, Manchester United team, Real Madrid teams of the past, you know, that built around a Butragueño or, you know, Michel or someone like that, or a Milan team, you know, built around, you know, Franco Baresi or something like that. And the financial fair play rules, as we've stated, don't appear to favour that anymore. Yeah. So how are these great teams, these great dynasties, and Manchester City say, you know, if Manchester City ever had to go down the FFP route, well, who are the players who could cash out? Well, Phil Foden, 100 million, thanking thee. You know, Chelsea, Mason Mount, having to do that now.
Yeah. I think the point, though, is that, like, United probably aren't, for all these, you can say, no disrespect to him as a player, but United aren't going to build around Scott McTominay, are they?
But I've always thought, Mark, that Scott McTominay, you know, is the type of player that Fergie would get 15 games a season where it was like, you know, Scott, I've got this game in mind for you 2 weeks down the, and you do a marking job on, I don't know, Gianfranco Zola or whoever. Mm. You know, he's the type of bits and pieces player that maybe in modern football you're not really allowed anymore.
My point is more that they only need to sell Scott McTominay or whoever, or these home ground players. They only would be prevented in this scenario from building a home ground team because they haven't managed the budget properly in the first place. It's not something that City would really get into because they'd probably be a lot more savvier in terms of their squad.
Well, they'd find a sponsor from somewhere, Mark. I think we know that. But,
yeah, and you know, we should point out, obviously, with City, they sold a whackload of players this year. I mean, you know, they sold Sterling to Chelsea. Now, did they make money on transfers this year while signing Haaland? So, you know, I mean, when you've got players who are just playing brilliantly, it's always easier to sell them, which is a problem that Man United have had the opposite side of that problem and trying to get rid of players who haven't played well. Let's talk a little bit then about some of the guys that have been linked, because this Mason Mount thing is kind of the big story at the moment. I saw him at the Formula One being asked about it and giving a sort of non-committal answer. It seems as though Chelsea want more than 50 million for a player who's already in the last, or who's going into the last year of his contract. Obviously Chelsea have maybe overpaid for a few, so they're looking to make some back. What do you actually make of Mason Mount though, Mark? Because he is a player who, despite having achieved a lot, won the Champions League, played for England in international tournaments, there's a lot of people he doesn't seem to impress. You know, I saw Roy Keane last week saying, basically, not for me, you know, Mason Mount, not for me. Why then do people like, I guess, Erik ten Hag, you know, Gareth Southgate and Frank Lampard rate him so highly?
I think, I get that when people say that about Mount, and I think he's prone, particularly when I was like covering England more closely and doing a lot of their games, he doesn't have a real impact at times, and I think he's sometimes an easy fall guy for that fact. You know, it's often the case that if a player isn't making that many decisive plays in possession of the ball particularly, then you look at them and you think, what exactly do you do here? And it does feel like that Mount falls into that category sometimes. But I think it's a category that actually other players have fallen into in the past. And once you find a particular role for them, once you, you know, give them something that's a bit more defined, then they actually, you know, they play an important part within the team structure. And I think that's probably how Ten Hag sees it. I know everybody talks about Mount's work out of possession, and it's something that I think United could desperately improve on. I think what Ten Hag would like is a player in that midfield who can take the ball off the back four and bring it up the pitch, and that's exactly why he was so keen on Frankie de Jong last summer. I don't think Mason Mount's that player, but I think in the kind of restricted market that United are probably working in, with, again, the FFP considerations with homegrown quotas, things like that, and simply availability, because that comes down to it. When you're a club in United's position and you haven't to prioritise and look at different positions on the pitch, because there's several that need attention.
John, where do you come down on Mount? Would you be advising them? You gotta you know, you got to push the boat out for this guy. You got to make this happen. This guy can be transformative. Are you like Roy Keane saying, yeah.
I'm not in the camp of thinking he's a transformative player. I think he's a good player. I think a couple of years ago when, I suppose, Chelsea were in that position where they switched from Lampard over to Tuchel, Mount was a very important player for them then, and I think he had a good Euros. But that's a couple of years ago, and things haven't quite gone as you'd expect since then. I think, obviously, Mount, as several other players have found, has got lost in, well, the Chelsea circus, and no disgrace in that. What does that transfer remind me of? I mean, it may be a little bit different at times in the career, but it does remind me a little bit of when Joe Cole joined Liverpool.
Joe Cole, though. Joe Cole was kind of burnt out at that stage. I mean, physically, yeah. I don't think he was up to it anymore. You know, who knows what might have happened if he'd gone when he was Mount's age. Maybe, you know.
I really like Joe Cole as a player, but yeah. But it's one of those things, actually, where consider it's actually a regional thing, you know. Players moving from London to Manchester or Liverpool, is that a common thing?
Beckham, you've already mentioned he was.
Well, David had been there since he was, you know, 13 or 14.
Teddy Sheringham, of course.
But Teddy wasn't like because he drove his Ferrari down Deansgate, you know.
Paul Konchesky to Liverpool.
Yes, well, this is what I'm getting at, Mark. Yeah, I mean, even Ray Wilkins, who was a very good player, was not particularly popular in Manchester until he sort of left. And
because he was from London.
Because he was from Londoner, yeah. You know, we're very parochial, you know, in England. And I do wonder. I mean, listen, okay, Mason Mount moves to Manchester, and they live in that Cheshire enclave that, you know, Mark will know all about, and. Not saying that he lives there, but and you do live in this sort of footballer world, of course. But it does seem, I mean, you know, I'm not sure that it's a big. I mean, who else has made the move up there? Londoners. You see, Peter Crouch, of course, you know, was pretty settled in Liverpool, born in Macclesfield. You see, he's a man with northern roots. So that would be one thing that to point out. Is Mason? I mean, okay. Mark is more abreast of what Manchester United want for next season. Who are the players that are, you know, top level that Ten Hag is obsessed by? Harry Kane is the top one, isn't he?
He's another Londoner, you know.
Another Londoner. Well, that is interesting. Maybe he wants an enclave of Londoners. You know, Harry Kane and Mason Mount living next door to each other, like Steve Bruce and Peter Schmeichel used to do 30 years ago. Maybe something like that. And then there's a goalkeeper as well, I presume is part of it. Who would that be? David Raya of Brentford, maybe? Yeah, very good with the ball at his feet.
So you've sold off the Golden Gloves, David Raya, or rather you've let him go. You've let him leave.
I think...
The Golden Glove.
The Golden Glove himself, I think... Wembley was another a big occasion when De Gea let himself and Manchester United down. I'm reminded of the game over in what's the city called in Poland? Sorry, remind
Gdansk.
Me. Gdansk. Gdansk. Yes. Yeah. I'm reminded of the game in Gdansk that Mark was at with the penalties. And then his goalkeeping performance at Wembley was not fantastic, was it, by any means?
No.
I think that's it for him. You know, he's not quite Jim Leighton, but, you know, time's up, mate. And then you're looking at...
Well, before we move on there, I just want... Do you think that's the case, Mark, that you know, because you see conflicting reports about De Gea, you know, that Manchester United are going to extend this contract was one thing that I saw. I mean, what do you think they should do and what do you think they will do regarding De Gea?
Should do, I would say it's probably time now.
So release him. He's finished his contract. I mean, they have the option to extend it. Is that the situation? I mean, his contract will expire and if they don't want to renew it, then he'll leave.
the situation is that his contract is expiring. They, you know, most United contracts come with a 1 year extension that can get triggered. That was already done last year, so his contract's up. There's again, you say about conflicting reports. I think if De Gea was doing a lot of interviews a couple of months ago, where he'd be asked about the situation, he said that it's going to be fine. It's all going to be agreed. Don't worry. The fact that it's still not 100% over the line confirmed and on United's website, I think it leaves still a little bit of a grey area there. What do I think will happen? I hate making predictions like this, but I think he'll probably stay. But look, I think there's still a possibility that he could go. I think that Ten Hag's answers on him over the last month, 2 months. You mentioned about the golden glove there. He's always been so protective of him, and he's always tried to talk up positives about his performances. It is true that he's got the golden glove. It is true he got the most clean sheets. Whether clean sheets should really be reflective of a goalkeeper is a different debate. Look, he's used those arguments. You've been able to poke holes in them. But I thought it was really interesting yesterday that when he was asked two questions about De Gea in his post-match press conference, and the second one was about his kicking and his distribution. And having already gone through the routine of defending him and talking him up, he had to take a step back and admit and concede really that, yeah, when it comes to De Gea and his distribution in particular, there are things, aspects of United's game that they desperately need to improve on that have held them back and that need to be fixed. And look, I don't think there's any way of fixing David De Gea's distribution at this stage. You saw yesterday how often he was kicking it long.
Well, it was the worst thing almost about yesterday was how much better Ortega was than him at all this basic stuff. And this guy is like, he's an extra at Manchester City, and he was better than De Gea.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And like, you only have to look at that first goal. Ortega's long kick upfield plays a part in that. And I know, look, it's a long kick upfield, and I think Pep afterwards was talking down the fact that it was part of some brilliant scheme. But he that kick goes into the right-hand side of the pitch where Haaland's gone to, where he can win an easy duel. I think it's against Casemiro, but it's a duel that he's always going to win. That's the kind of kicking, even if it's long, even if it's a big kick upfield, it's the stuff that you don't see De Gea do, because he's not thinking about what areas of the pitch it needs to go. He's not thinking about...
He's just thinking, get
rid of it. And that's the difference. And that's what's holding United back. And I think you've just noted a little bit more, I don't know whether you call it scepticism or whatever, in Ten Hag's, the way that he spoke and the way that he spoke yesterday about him. And that, again, I think that just plays into the fact that even now, with about 3 weeks to run on this contract, we're still not got a definitive decision on it.
Yeah, John, I guess we don't expect Wout Weghorst to be sticking around. It didn't ultimately go that well for him. They do need a centre forward, though. And my question is, how far do you think, do you believe that they're seriously going for Harry Kane, who I see now being linked with Real Madrid, who obviously have lost Karim Benzema, he's going to Saudi Arabia, and maybe they think Harry Kane is going to be their next Galactico. Would you urge Manchester United into a bidding war against Real Madrid for Harry Kane?
Real Madrid seriously interested in Harry Kane.
I don't know, John. There's reports suggest Real Madrid are interested.
We're in bullshit season here, chaps, aren't we?
We're in bullshit season. All we can do is look into our own hearts and say what's there. What's in your heart regarding Harry Kane? He is from London, but he is, on the other hand, very good.
He's very good, yeah. He is from London. He could possibly live in Wilmslow and deal with it. You know, it's not that different from Hertfordshire. Could he live in, one of the environs of Madrid, where, say, Steve McManaman had made his own home, but Michael Owen did not? Interesting. I think, actually, talking of David De Gea, I think what Manchester United managers have lacked since Alex Ferguson, among many qualities, is that ruthlessness of getting rid of people. Louis van Gaal attempted to do it in a rather ham-fisted way. Jose Mourinho even, would play this hard man stuff, but wasn't able to get rid of them. What whoever owns Manchester United, and of course this is the other issue that hangs over it all, and to which, you know, we could do another four-hour special without actually getting anywhere of what's going to happen. Someone needs to do what Ferguson did at a certain point, which is just get rid of players, bomb out players. And if you're Erik ten Hag and this guy, David De Gea, as nice a guy as he is, as long as he's been, and he's let the club down, get rid of him. You know, Wout Weghorst came in, nice lad, you know, gave everyone a smile. You've almost got to give him the Fergie Ralph Milne treatment. You know, thanks for coming, Ralph, see ya. You know, and that's... It's something that United have lacked for a long time. And a lot of that is to do with these, actually the deal that Mark talks about. Your contract finishes, but because the club is looking to save a bit of money and make a bit of money in the transfer market, you get offered this extra deal, so you've got some worth in the transfer market. Well, actually, it ends up as a completely false economy. You end up in a state of, you know, Leyland's Phil Jones qualifying for 12 years of money. Now, bless him, you know, obviously that is a fairly tragic story as footballers go, in the sense that, okay, he's a millionaire, but he's very unhappy with the way
he's had a hard time. He's had a hard time, but he has certainly been well paid. And they gave him a contract extension after he had already sort of fallen out of the picture a little bit, on the basis that they surely were going to be able to sell him, and then obviously that didn't materialise.
No, exactly, and there's been too much of that. Now, I don't know if it's easy for other clubs to do it. I suspect other clubs have a similar problem. Tottenham are going to have a similar problem. Chelsea, obviously, are going to have big issues with this. But there does need to be a point where someone like... If you place Ten Hag in charge, you've got to give him the self-determination to say, I want Harry Kane. I want Frankie de Jong. I want David Raya, let's say that. Let's just try and make it happen. And the big problem is, of course, the ownership and... Let's see if big Jim Ratcliffe or the Qataris come in. Let's see if that changes. But I'm not convinced it will, because there's so much that, as I said at the outset, Manchester United have got such a long way back to be where they want to be.
Okay. Well, just then, Mark, bearing in mind what John's been saying there about ruthlessness, to bring it back to someone he mentioned earlier on in this conversation, Jadon Sancho, who... You know, as far as I can make out, it seems to be the closest thing to a scapegoat that's emerged among, you know, on the United side, among, you know, when they're looking at this thinking, where did this go wrong? I think there's a general acceptance. Man City are just a much better team. You know, the result ended up being narrow. You know, we gave it a go. We weren't good enough. We didn't really expect to be. But where was Jadon Sancho all game? And where has he been for 2 years since he's, you know, I can feel a little bit of that going on. Like his bad performances have almost been under the radar to a surprising extent for a guy who costs more than £70 million. You know, there's usually a bit more kind of, maybe there have been so many other problems that people haven't really identified him as a problem. The drop-off, though, between what he was doing for Dortmund and what he has done for Manchester United is stunning. You know, it's way more than your usual sort of Bundesliga, you know, you expect a bit of Bundesliga attacks or whatever. He just looks like a completely different player. And this has now been with different teammates. You know, Ronaldo was there for a while. He's not there anymore. Different managers. You know, there was Ole. Now there's Ten Hag. And the one thing that's consistent is this underperformance. So what do you think is going on with this guy? And what do you think, how do you think United are thinking about him at the moment? If ruthlessness is something they want to bring back, then is Sancho on the block?
I think that maybe if you wanted to bring ruthlessness back, but like there's almost so many different other things that need to be done before that. Like we were talking about the players before that need to be get off the books, that I don't think Sancho is a huge priority. I don't think that and he's obviously, there was this season, just this past season as well, he had that break, extended break, which Ten Hag put down to physical and mental issues that he had. So, but being totally frank and trying to be a bit more ruthless in the answer myself, he hasn't delivered on what he expected. And it's one thing that I've got more wrong than anybody else, because I thought, having watched him at Dortmund, I thought that this would be a player that came in and, you know, at the time I didn't particularly rate United as a great team, but I thought he would be a a great player in a not so great team. It hasn't happened. I think you could. His situation reminds me a little bit, and I'm not. I don't think it's like for like, but it does remind me a little bit of Grealish's at City last year, in that he has little noticeable impact on games. It comes back to what I was saying before about Mount as well, kind of. But with Grealish, I think the difference was there was always a bit of a misconception about Grealish in that he never really got like loads of goals and assists. He was more a guy that would take the ball, move the ball, do a job. People were looking for something different with him. So with Sancho, though, like that was people had a misconception about the player Grealish was. With Sancho, I just feel like nobody really knows anymore the player Sancho is.
Because he did used to get lots and lots of goals and assists, you know, so goals, and he was, you know, averaging more than a goal involvement per game, which really very, very few players are capable of doing. And that's kind of the expectation, I suppose, that he came with.
Yeah. And look, in the past, I think you put that down to everything you said there. Like he came in under Ollie, and the worst part of Ollie when it was going, you know, going spiraling the drain. He came in at the same time as Ronaldo, and that was a huge gravitational force that pulled everything away from every other player in the team. And then, that was a long time ago. We've had Ten Hag since. He started the season well, dropped off. I think there is something in this idea that I see a lot, that he needs players around him, that he doesn't have that burst that you expect from a winger, that you perhaps see from Garnacho when he comes off the bench. That is something that just engages fans and engages, you know, observers more than Sancho's style of play. He needs players around him. He takes a lot of touches on the ball. He can look a bit hesitant sometimes. And maybe he'd be better suited to a system that had a lot more possession than United have had this season, because they have, I think, as John mentioned, a lot of it has been counter-attacking stuff, and he just doesn't seem to thrive in those types of situations. I think Ten Hag's still playing him at the minute, but sometimes it's felt a little bit more out of necessity, like just because of injuries in other places, or because he doesn't quite feel that Garnacho is ready to start. But personally, I would have started Garnacho for Saturday. I think we had to do a predicted team, and I said that was the one player that I changed, him for Sancho, from the team that started. I think he's a player that just has an impact, whether it's late in games or whatever.
Yeah,
he makes things happen, and Sancho doesn't at the minute, and that's the difference.
So do you feel, John, that you know, third season it could all come good for Sancho? Because I mean the concern that I would have for him at this point is I don't see how he gets in the team, because, you know, if United sign a striker, we'll probably be seeing quite a lot of Rashford on the left. The manager paid 100 million euros for Anthony, and Garnacho, as Mark has been saying, looks much more exciting. You know, he's direct, he's fiery. You know, Ten Hag obviously didn't pick him ahead of him for the cup final, but I think that might be different next year. So I'm kind of looking at it going, Sancho might get it together, but he's going to be sitting on the bench and no one will know.
I think Garnacho, let's talk of ruthlessness. You could cash him out now to Real Madrid for 100 million, say, we'll take Harry Kane. But setting that aside, I think Sancho would be a fantastic Crystal Palace player. You know, and I don't say that mockingly. What I'm saying is that...
So you're saying he reminds you of Zaha, who also didn't succeed at Manchester United?
Yeah, which doesn't lessen Zaha's quality as a player. He's one of my favourite players to watch in the Premier League. But also the style of play that you're playing, and I think... United don't have the players that link with Sancho's style of play. He's a top level club. He's lacking a bit too much in consistency. Now, you know, at a club like Palace, at West Ham, or someone like that, you can just be a street player, have fun, and still be a good player, but it's almost as if, listen, if a player's taking breaks mid-season for whatever reason, and, you know, it's someone that's not reached the potential, again, let's get back to this ruthless thing. Get rid of him, let him be someone else's problem. That has to be the way that Manchester United think. Now, they paid 76 million for him, again, which goes back to the financial mismanagement, the way that they always get the worst out of these deals. It's a shame. He's a talented player. He's probably a good lad. But it's not worked out. And then you have to, you know, move on to the next one. And the thing is, as we've stated, there are other players to come in, fulfil that role. Well, you know, how much can you get for Sancho? Well, OK, there's one to add to your pile.
OK, well, John is pulling the plug on Sancho. we'll see how that one develops over the summer. And it's one thing's for sure, it's going to be a big transfer window. It's a big window of transfer speculation at Manchester United for another summer. Can I say, John and Mark, thanks a million for coming on and talking to us about all that today.
Cheers.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
For fuck's sake!
We need to get back to facts here, because there seems to be a bit of emotion creeping in. What you've just said really isn't true.
Well, no. No, what I said... I'm not saying...
I don't know what you're saying, to be honest with you.
Okay.
I mean,
all I can... If you found someone on the street...
Am I interviewing you, or are you interviewing me? He's a goat, he's a god, he's a
man, he's a guru. You cheeky bastard. You're one microscopic cog in his catastrophic plan,
designed and directed by his red right hand. He did. I've heard.
Let me finish.
What happened to Chelsea?
For fuck's sake.
Well, this is going splendidly, everybody.
Put the cameras up if you want. Let's have a chat. Everybody would think that the appointment of Jose Mourinho would have been a great appointment for Manchester United to win trophies. That they would win trophies under Jose Mourinho.
Well, I don't think everybody would have thought that, but I think somebody who didn't know a lot about football would have thought that.
What, the Manchester United? Jose Mourinho?
Yeah.
You cheeky bastard.
For fuck's sake.
You cheeky bastard.
For fuck's sake.
You cheeky bastard.
For fuck's sake.
Okay, Ken, there's plenty of international football coming up this month. Two games for the men's team, as well as a friendly and a World Cup squad to be announced for the women's team. So if you're interested in that, or in the upcoming Champions League final, which Ken will be attending for us on Saturday, Manchester City against Internazionale of Milan, why don't you think about giving the World Service a rattle? It's €5 a month plus VAT, depending on where in the world you're signing up. And you can just go to secondcaptains.com/join if you're interested. We'd love to have you with us. We'd love to have everyone with us, wouldn't we, Ken?
Yes, absolutely. Everybody. The more the merrier.
Everybody. The more the merrier. Exactly. All that remains for us is to wish you a very happy rest of your bank holiday Monday. Hope you're out enjoying the good weather. We and Owen will chat to you on the World Service tomorrow. And remember that the second half of the podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network. Sloan, August Bannacht.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys. It is not war and death and famine, it's not that at all. It's the opposite of that, it's the persuasion of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.